Hello, I'm Bruce Tinsmore, voice of Pinky and Arthur and Dad and lots of other stuff. This is number 0281, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0281. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Leo J. Battenhausen, author of Social Side, How America is Loving Itself to Death. He talks about January being the biggest month of the year for divorce filings.
We're seeing a lot of reports from legal agencies and attorneys' offices, divorce attorneys' offices, that are saying anywhere from 60 to 80% of divorce rates are coming in January for people that want to file. And that 60 and 80%, they have been blamed on some form of social media that's causing the distress in the family.
Paul J.J. Payak from the Global Language Monitor is back on the show with the top words and phrases of 2014. And the top word isn't even a word.
About a quarter way through last year, after about a quarter or two, we started seeing emoji, E-M-J-I, as one of the top words. And as we went through the year, we started breaking the individual emoji, and we were actually shocked to see how many times the heart emoji could be tracked online.
Stuart Nolman is on with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman, and Book Banter starts 2015 with something completely different, with my review of John Cleese's memoir, So Anyway. So take a silly walk to complain about that ex-parrot. It's happening soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0281 was actor Bruce Dinsmore. And thank you very much, Bruce, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Much appreciated. A program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? We start off with a couple of stories that you could consider major ironies. Number one, three homes on the Pacific Ocean near Grayland, Washington, were washed away by violent rainstorms in early December. But the residents had seen this coming. The longtime local name for the area is Washaway Beach. Said one, "I knew it was going to happen sooner or later, but I had hoped it wasn't this soon." And this next story has to be the irony of ironies. In November, an airline's advertising staff created a catchy slogan to attract impulse travelers. Want to go somewhere but don't know where? And they also convinced management to send it via Twitter to the airline's thousands of followers. Spoiler alert, the airline was Malaysia Airlines, whose flight 370 still has not been found. Yeah, perhaps that slogan should be rethought, you think? Meanwhile, Britain's Home Office revealed in November, by releasing archived documents from 1982, that among the contingency suggestions for worst-case nuclear attack on the country was commissioning psychopaths to help keep order. "They are very good in crises," an advocate wrote, "because they have no feelings for others nor moral code and tend to be very intelligent and logical, and thus could do quite well at containing the vigilante survivalist enclaves that might develop in the event parts of the kingdom became lawless." After an apparently thoughtful debate, the suggestion was not agreed to. Okay, how do we know that the psychopaths aren't already running the place? Yeah. Okay, here's a compelling explanation. 45-year-old Eric Opitz, who was indicted on 13 counts of fraud in Philadelphia in October, had explained that the reason he needed human growth hormone, that he would resell, despite being 6'3" and 450 pounds, was that he was really a dwarf and feared that he would recede if he stopped the medication. Now, at what point in his pea-sized brain did he actually think that someone was going to fall for that explanation? Maybe at 6'3", the oxygen isn't reaching his head. At a recent art show at Paris's Palais de Tokyo, Italian artist Sven Sachsalber, for his provocative piece, brought in a large haystack on November 13th, dropped a needle into it, and gave himself 2 days to find it. Late the next day, he picked it up. Okay, at this point, I think it's important to refute that age-old adage. Finding a needle in a haystack is not difficult. All you need is a magnet. What would be difficult is finding a particular needle in a stack of needles. Now that's time-consuming. So if it took this guy 2 days to find that needle, he's not doing it right. Okay, we have 3 crimes here from the decidedly not major crimes unit, all taking place in the UK. Number 1, 4 officers responded in Tayport, Scotland, in July to arrest 65-year-old Irene Clark, who spent 48 hours in jail after committing the crime of swatting her husband with a magazine while arguing over television programs, causing a paper cut. Number 2, 38-year-old Christopher Saunders pleaded guilty in North Devon, England, in November to possession of 0.09 grams of marijuana. Value, 14 cents. And number 3, 44-year-old Keith Shannon was sentenced to 2 years probation in Letterkenny, Ireland, in November for twice being caught swiping tester packets of aftershave at a Boots store. Value, 2 cents each. Now, these stories certainly do put the petty in petty crime. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, "You can't make this up," said Oakland County, Michigan Sheriff Michael Bouchard. He says 51-year-old Brian Joseph Kreskio was arrested for stealing an on-duty ambulance from a hospital in Pontiac. He wasn't ill. He told the deputy he was hoping to go to the booby trap to see pole dancing, Bouchard said. The strip club is in Detroit, about 30 miles away. Why not take a bus? Apparently, he said there was no public transportation available, Bouchard said. Again, you can't make this stuff up. Brian, in the stolen ambulance, mostly went east, though, rather than south, and was caught in Sterling Heights. He apparently made no attempt to break into the ambulance's drug box, but has a record for previous arrests for robbery, breaking and entering, trespassing, and drug possession. He was held on $5,000 bond. Oh, he'll see pole dancing of an entirely different kind when he's behind bars. Anyway, on to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. With the holiday season now behind us, for some families, the joy of the time period is going to give way to an entirely different emotion. The month of January has earned the title of Divorce Month over the past several years, and social media may have a role to play in the statistics. To talk about this phenomenon, we are joined by Leo J. Battenhausen. He's the author of Social Side: How America is Loving Itself to Death. He joins us on the line from New Jersey. Hi, Leo.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. My pleasure very much. So
how long has January been the phenomenon of being divorce month?
Well, we're looking at from 2008. These are statistics from 2008 until 2011. So, we don't have the stats from 12 to now, but it's been catching up and growing since 2008.
And as I said in the intro, social media plays a role in this. Exactly how does that work out?
Well, it does, because I don't know if you are familiar, but in America, we're seeing a lot of reports from legal agencies and attorneys' offices, divorce attorneys' offices, that are saying anywhere from 60 to 80% of divorce rates are coming in January for people that want to file. And that 60 and 80%, they have been blamed on some form of social media that's causing the distress in the family, which is pretty amazing and pretty shocking.
Is it possible that what social media does isn't exacerbate the situation so much as basically put a magnifying glass on a problem that's already there?
Well, that's very possible, absolutely. And that's the thing, Peter. We're seeing families or one spouse or the other finding their needs, you know, being met, whatever needs they may be of acceptance or support or you know, gratification coming from social media instead of getting them from our spouses and from our family. So that's the other side of this coin, is that our, you know, we're letting our families and responsibilities be depleted or taken away or ignored because we're so infatuated with social media and what it provides us for the needs we're not getting in the house, or at least not trying to get from the house where we should be.
Well, I was just about to ask, is it a chicken versus the egg, or which came first kind of situation? Is there a problem in the home, that's why people go online, or are people online creating a problem in the home?
Well, my best guess would be that there is a problem in the home first. That is probably the chicken or the egg, whichever you want to look at it. And we're looking to find some kind of place to fit in or some kind of gratification for what we're missing in our marriages or in our family. And instead of working on those issues or being honest about them, we're finding it very easy to click on whatever sites we go to and having virtual relationships, which can very easily turn into physical relationships, and or, you know, we're meeting a lot of one of the big problems is we're meeting like people from our past that maybe lost old flames that become magnificently reignited because we have connected again. And we these were mostly where affairs of physical content come from. So it's a very scary thing, and you know, and when, instead of like talking to this to our spouses about this, we're going online to get these needs gratified.
Well, you mentioned reconnecting with one's past via social media, and I wanted to bring that aspect up of it because I'm assuming, just based on the ages of people who are getting divorced, that we're talking about people who did not grow up with social media. And the reason why I bring that point up is that if we extrapolate this situation, 10, 15 years into the future, you're going to have people who are going to get together and break apart who have grown up with social media, and therefore their perception of social media and privacy is totally different than those who are going through it now.
You're absolutely right. And I talk about this in Social Side, where I discussed that there is no reference point for those of us that are probably about 35 or younger today, of a real life outside of social media and outside of technology. So we are a society that is moving very forward into our adulthood without a reference point of actually going out and knowing people and socializing, you know, in person, instead of relying on technology, cell phones, and social media to connect and to be, you know, who we are. And that's a very scary thing, you know. And I don't know about in Canada where you are, but right now the United States has more unmarried people than married people. And this is the first time in history that that's happened. And I do believe that's a direct result of what's going on with social media and the conveniences it provides, if you want to call them that.
Well, if when it comes to the runaway train that is the January divorce filings, it's a little late now because we are in January. But in your estimation, what should some people on either side of the situation look for as far as signs before they reach this point?
Okay, that's a very good question. We need to watch our spouses. If they're spending too much time online or not communicating, you know, we hear this all the time. I'm a therapist, and I hear this all the time. we don't communicate right. And I know it sounds like psychology of marriage counseling 101, but it is very true. Well, if we're not talking to each other about, you know, what we need, or, you know, appreciating each other, or showing each other those signs, those physical signs of appreciation and devotion, then we're in the wrong ballpark. So we need to watch. We need to look for the signs from our spouse. If they're online a lot of the times, that's a big red flag. So, you know, and if we're not talking to each other, and if family obligations are being kind of ignored or forgotten about, that's another big red flag. And one of us, you know, whoever the healthy one is in the relationship that wants this marriage to work, needs to come forth and say, listen, you're spending a lot of time out of the family and on the computer. Is there something we need to talk about? And it's very simple as that. And hopefully, you know, we can get some help and try to work this stuff out, or talk to each other and try to find out what is missing and what we need to, you know, get back on track.
It's interesting that you say that somebody might be spending too much time online. I'm just wondering if, as you say, the healthy spouse in that situation, how do they combat that situation if they have children, especially teenagers? Because let's face it, a teenager these days doesn't even look up anymore. They're always online.
I know. Oh, my gosh, do I know. Yeah, that's another thing. And that's another topic, maybe. But we do need to limit our kids' times on their computers or cell phones. And there was a study out recently. It was a very big study, and I forget the title of it, but I could get that to you. But that study proved that if our kids are spending 45 minutes or more, or no, I'm sorry, 45 minutes is fine, but anything over 45 minutes online for a socialization or fun time, as in computer games and video games, they're going to see a decline in socialization, emotional stability, and schoolwork. So we as parents really need to step up to the plate and tell our kids, listen, no, this is not, you can't just live your life online. And we need to find a way to make that happen if our kids are going to be going to grow up and to become socialized people like we should be. Because what they're doing now, you know, this whole technology thing, it does not compute, so to speak, with the way we're geared, and kids' minds don't know how to really grasp, you know, computer worlds compared to real life work and real life relationships, and it's very important to do that. So if we're seeing that, and one of our parents is online all the time, you know, we need to really wake up and say, hey, you know, what kind of example am I setting here for my son or my daughter?
Interesting topic indeed. The book is called Social Side, How America is Loving Itself to Death. Leo, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, Peter. I appreciate you having me on.
Leo J. Battenhausen, author of Social Side, How America is Loving Itself to Death. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0281, and you'll find links to Leo's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Paul J.J. Payak from the Global Language Monitor about the words and phrases of 2014. Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, we have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. A West Florida woman faces felony assault charges after she reportedly attacked her grandmother for denying a Facebook friend request. Deputies arrested 27-year-old Rachel Ann Hayes for aggravated battery on an elderly person. According to authorities, Hayes slapped the 72-year-old multiple times at a home in Clearwater, Florida. The woman was Hayes' grandmother, and that Hayes' arrest affidavit indicated alcohol was a factor in the assault. The attack allegedly stemmed from an argument between the two over Hayes' Facebook moniker. Hayes' grandmother refused to accept her friend request unless the name was changed, according to authorities. Apparently, Hayes' Facebook name was too obscene for her grandmother's tastes. Hayes initially left the residence but returned, and in the ensuing argument, she slapped her grandmother multiple times at the threshold of the door before the elderly woman was able to retreat inside. Deputies arrived on scene and arrested Hayes, who was released from the Pinellas County Jail on $10,000 bond. Hayes's jail records show prior arrests for alcohol-related incidents, including a DUI last year, violation of probation in relation to the DUI, and a September charge of disorderly conduct for urinating in public. Now, I don't know what the offensive Facebook moniker was, but I'm guessing that not only is Rachel not a Facebook friend with her grandmother, she's now probably out of the will, too. And a man called police in Hoover, Alabama, to report a woman driving erratically. The caller also alleged that she was smoking crack cocaine and had a child in the car. Officials located the car in a parking lot, and when one of them approached the vehicle, he saw 44-year-old Barry Williams, allegedly with a crack pipe in her hand. When Williams rolled down the window, the officers said the smell of burnt crack cocaine was overwhelming. Williams got out of the car, saying she was a social worker and the pipe was her husband's, but eventually allegedly confessed to smoking the crack herself. Williams was arrested, and the 5-year-old girl in the vehicle was taken into protective custody. Further investigation determined that Williams is indeed a social worker. She's a case manager at a substance abuse treatment center. Wow. You know, when she tells her clients, "I know what you're going through," she's not kidding, is she? Yeah. A Boston man who police say fell naked through the ceiling of a woman's bathroom at Boston's airport and then assaulted an elderly man has been ordered held without bail pending a hearing. Cameron Schenck was arraigned on charges that include attempted murder, assault and battery on a person over 60, and lewd and lascivious conduct. Police say the 26-year-old Schenck fell through the ceiling. He had allegedly sneaked into the bathroom, undressed inside a stall, and climbed into the ceiling crawl space. Police say he then fled the bathroom and assaulted an 84-year-old man. Schenck's lawyer said he is a student studying economics at Harvard Extension School and has no history of mental illness. Well, he does now. And we often have to marvel at the intelligence of animals. We have a few stories here to illustrate that very fact. A November story from Leon C. England reported that a Senegal parrot, apparently feeling restive with its owners on holiday, managed to pick two locks on its cage and fly away. The second lock had been installed as an insurance after an earlier lock-picking escape. Also, a missing African gray parrot was returned to its Torrance, California owner in October after a hiatus in which the parrot had learned to speak Spanish. Now, on the other hand, a hungry 5-foot-long black rat snake in Verona, Pennsylvania, had to be saved by surgery after it failed to distinguish between chicken eggs in a coop, tasty, and a nearby ceramic egg, life-threatening organ failure. So, if you're keeping score, it's bird smart, snake not so smart. Yet we disparagingly use the term bird brain in our vernacular. Perhaps that should change to snake brain. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, two 18-year-olds in Boise, Idaho, were charged with burglary after cruising the parking lot of a shopping area looking for unlocked car doors. After apprehending the male and female suspects, officers found their own car was stocked with allegedly stolen clothing and electronics taken from stores and other cars. Their real names? Amanda Miranda Panda and Tristan Bubba Parsons. You know, some people are doomed to a criminal life the moment their parents fill out those birth certificates. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Another year has come and gone, and with it, another year filled with top words and phrases, which is the reason we always invite Paul J.J. Payak back on the show. He's from the Global Language Monitor, and he spends his time tracking trends in the English language. He joins us on the line right now from Austin, Texas. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good to hear from you again.
Good to hear from you, too. Happy holidays to you, sir.
Yeah, and I guess it's that time of year.
Yes, it is. And I'm looking at the website, the Language Monitor, languagemonitor.com, and
right.
It seems to be that one of the big words is not actually a word, it's an emoji.
Right, and that surprised us, because what we do is we track these things all year long. Our business is that we track trends globally so companies know what they can expect and things of that nature, you know, for branding, marketing, and actually for events and things of that nature, too. And so about a quarter way through last year, after about a quarter or two, we started seeing emoji, E-M-J-I, as one of the top words. And as we went through the year, we started breaking down the individual emoji, and we were actually shocked to see how many times the heart emoji could be tracked online.
Is part of it just the fact that it's relative ease of use? It's, you know, an emoji actually says so much in just a graphic than writing out words.
Right. We're going to have to figure out, because it's not a graphic that where a picture is worth 1,000 words. But you know, emoji is worth something. I don't know exactly how many words it's equal to. Maybe we can figure that out next year. But it's not because it's simple, because it's not always simple to get it, okay? I mean, I don't know what type of device you use. I have a Samsung, and my daughter has an Apple, et cetera, an iPhone. And there's different ways that the emoji are rendered, and so they look a little different, and sometimes they're harder to get and sometimes not as hard. You may have to go actually press the keyboard 5 different times before you get to the heart. And so that doesn't make it simple, because you just write L-O-V-E, so it'd be fewer keystrokes. The point is that we're seeing a really interesting phenomenon, whereas we are going back in history, right, going back in time, and we're seeing the beginning of a graphic alphabet that's actually being accepted worldwide, and it has pretty serious standards right now.
Now, I'm looking at also your list of the top words of 2014, and the one thing I seem to notice that there's a pattern here, and that is a lot of the words that are popular these days tend to have a direct correlation to either online or computer use of some kind.
Right. Well, that's the amazing thing. It's that, remember, say, 20 years ago, when a web first started being used and people, you know, AOL and things of that nature. And it really didn't have the same capacity that we have in a web right now. But I remember I would say, when an interview, people would say, what do you think? And I'd say, I think it's the biggest intellectual advance since the Renaissance. And people would say, oh, come now. How can you even say that? It's just computers. And it turns out that it is a computer that gets into every fiber of your life. You know, it's a way to communicate 24 hours a day globally from spot to spot. And it's an amazing thing. And it is affecting life to that depth degree. We also studied the first, we didn't release this yet. You might want to know in the next week or so, we're going to announce the top 15 words of the first 15 years of the 21st century. And then to make, see what the trends are that we're learning from the words. Well, of course, web is number one. I mean, it's just like it's all over the place. No matter what you do, what language, books, you know, magazines, Twitter accounts, everything can imagine. It's the web is there, and it's making this profound impact on every aspect of our life.
You mean you're doing something for the Quinn decennial?
Yes. I don't even try to say it again. How do you pronounce it?
Quindecennial.
Yeah, the quindecennial. And, you know, in what we do in Texas and in your Latin countries and like the southern United States, et cetera, is that there's the young girls have a coming out party on their quindecennial, okay, on their 15th anniversary. And then so we started playing with that and thinking, wow, you know, the 21st century is now ready to have its quindecennial. We can tell what's going to happen, or at least have strong ideas of what's going to happen for the rest of the century from what we've learned so far. And it's really a sobering experience to try to do that, because it's not all roses, as you can imagine.
Going quickly through the list of the top 15 words of 2014, as I mentioned, some of them are computer related. Now, we already mentioned the emoji, the heart emoji. Number two is hashtag, which
right.
Older people will just simply say number sign.
right, and pound sign.
And pound you know, sign, yes.
Before it's a pound, a number sign, after it's a pound, and now it's a hashtag. I mean, so it has like a triple threat there.
Yeah. Vape, for those who know about electronic cigarettes. So again, the electronic world steps in. Blood Moon, I'm surprised that that's as high as it is at number four. I mean, I know we had we had Blood Moons this past year, but still, I didn't think it would be that high.
No, but what makes it high is the words around it. Okay, we study just not the word, but the word around it. And every year, there's an apocalypse that's really high. Apocalyptic terms, and you know, remember it was the Mayan apocalypse and things of that nature. And so what it is always this portending doom, and they all surrounded the blood moon. So it's because of the phrase itself, but it's also because what surrounded it and what other things that were mentioned in tandem with it.
Now, there's also Nano on the list. That's at number five. Photobomb at number six, which we're going back to the computers as usual.
It's another gadget.
Now, number seven, Caliphate. How is that on the list? I must have missed that one.
Caliphate is on the list because of ISIS, the Islamic State that reared its ugly head five or six months ago in the Middle East. And caliphate is sometimes what we do is we look at the words and the words that surround them, okay? And caliphate, again, surrounded many of the things with the Islamic State and their plan for conquest, et cetera. it's quite interesting because basically what they do is they go back to the 8th century. And, you know, Spain, the Moors in Spain, and all that wonderful architecture and all. And every area that they ever touched, according to Islamic State, that any group of Islamics ever touched is rightfully theirs. And that's the caliphate. Mm. It comes up in different ways. We also have to be careful what we say because we don't know, like ISIS or ISIL or Islamic State, you don't know even how those words are going to end up, So right. we try to take a word that signifies all that. That's in the news a lot.
White privilege is in at number 8. Bay.
Oh, yeah, that's big political correct.
Bay, B-A-E. I'm not even familiar with that one. Is it number 9, a term of endearment?
Yeah, it's like a, with the hipsters, it's like my baby. Rather than have it my baby, it's my bay.
Oh, okay. So
the same syllable.
Yeah, it's always amazing.
I guess you're not a hipster up there in Montreal.
I guess not. But then again, I don't spend my time trying to shorten already short words.
that's the point. It's like Western civilization tries to get down everything to as short as possible. No wonder we're looking at emoji now as words.
Yeah. And by the way, I feel this goes back to the at sign. Why you need an at sign, which is basically replacing only 2 letters, is beyond me. But that's another story for another day.
Calligraphy. Some calligrapher came up with it. They did it. Really, if you look at the at sign and see how the et, and for Latin.
Right.
If you did that, you can see where it comes from.
More
from an elaborate ET, and then just became a
more computer terms. Number 10 is bash tag. Number 11 is transparency, which is a word we're hearing a lot about. Number 12, sustainable. And what does that say about all of us as a collective planet, that something dealing with saving the planet isn't in the top 10?
Well, it's like sustainable is an interesting story, though. We named it the top word of the year in 2006, and we got a lot of pushback on what's sustainable, what does sustainable mean, et cetera. But it's now almost like a business term. Like you have to have a sustainable platform for your corporation, and what are you doing to be sustainable and things like that. So that it's that high, it's pretty good. And if I included and we do it at we have different categories. Scientific words and green words and things of that nature. If we did that, climate change is always one of the top words broadly used in all these different categories. So that's part of the climate change, sustainable environmental movement.
Well, we're just about out of time, but it's always a pleasure to talk to you. But I got to ask you just one quick question. As somebody who works and runs the Global Language Monitor, is there a favorite word of yours for the 21st century, at least, or for 2014, at least one that we can say on the air?
Well, my favorite word of all time is stuff, S-T-U-F-F, which just happens to be the name of your show.
Although I spell it S-T-U-P-H, just to be different.
Well, you're very trendy, I guess. Pretty soon, it's just going to be a little emoji for stuff.
Yes,
but I love stuff because the universe is made of stuff. I have stuff in my pocket. Let's do stuff. I mean, it just has so many different meanings, and it's so useful. So I just love the word stuff.
Okay, Paul, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Okay, talk to you later. Thank you, Peter.
Paul J.J. Payak from the Global Language Monitor. Again, you can visit their website at www.languagemonitor.com. You can also go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0281, and you'll find links to Paul's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Several months before the Declaration of Independence was written in Philadelphia, Thomas Paine published a pamphlet called Common Sense. It helped spark the American Revolution by encouraging colonists to rethink the rules by which they were living, and today, it even holds lessons about the importance of making New Year's resolutions. In his opening paragraph, Paine wrote, and I quote, "A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom," end of quote. Common Sense was published in January, And I think that's fitting because Payne's advice is perfect for anyone considering a resolution to break a bad habit. Let's be fair. In today's language, what Payne was saying is that it's easy to lose sight of how wrong something is when it becomes an everyday part of one's life. By changing habits that don't serve us well, we can revolutionize our own life for the better. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, and now for something completely different, Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. I hope you're not pining for the fjords, are you?
No, I am not. And by the way, it's so nice to talk to you once again. I haven't spoken to you since last year.
I know these... these 365-day absences are really too much, actually.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Happy New Year, Peter.
Happy New Year to you too, sir. So what are we talking about this time around?
Well, we're going to talk about not silly walks or ex-parrots, but the man behind all that, John Cleese. You know, back in the 60s, he got a palm reading. He was in Washington, D.C., John Cleese, and this was what the assessment that he got from the palm reader. He said that your logical thinking side balances your creative side. Almost everyone has one side stronger than the other. Now, I think this accurately describes the multidimensional character of this most admired comedy legend, John Cleese. He will always be associated with his years as a founding member of the legendary British comedy troupe Monty Python's Flying Circus, where he has obtained a cult status for such characters as the frustrated dead parrot owner and the rather limber civil servant from the Ministry of Silly Walks, not to mention his role as the loud, rude, high-strung British resort town hotel owner Basil Fawlty on the hilarious TV series Fawlty Towers. Now, on the other side of this, Cleese also shows an intelligent, logical side, which he's displayed greatly as a university lecturer, a host of a series of business and industrial training videos, and author of books that deal with such sublime subjects as the human brain, life, and even the sport of soccer. And we get plenty of the two sides of John Cleese in his absorbing, recently published memoir, So Anyway. Now, I have to admit, when I started reading the book, it was rather slow at the beginning. His description of his life growing up in the Western English resort town of Western Supermare, and about his life, his early life attending private schools and sharpening his cricket skills, it reads like the England he grew up in during the period during and immediately following World War II, which was cold, logical, with a penchant for austerity. It's when Cleese gets to the point in the book where he grows into manhood and attends Cambridge University to study law, and where the book really picks up and becomes quite enjoyable to read. And this is especially when he, in the early 60s, when he joins Cambridge's highly regarded Footlights Drama Club and associates himself with fellow members who later become some of the biggest names in British comedy during the 1970s. Now, although Cleese's first roles with the Footlights Reviews were small, his writing skills and ability to churn out sketches, coupled with his manic acting talent, helped make the 62 and 63 Footlights Reviews the toast of England, which later evolved into a successful tour of New Zealand and a brief run on Broadway under the name of Cambridge Circus. But Cleese argues in the book that he is more content to create the sketches and the lines as a writer rather than perform them on stage, which was quite evident with he churned out a lot of scripts for The Frost Report in the 60s. Even the screenplay for the movie The Magic Christian with Peter Sellers and Ringo Starr. But there's also plenty of the intellectual side of Cleese in this book, as he impeccably describes his theories of comedy and what techniques are used to successfully make people laugh. He also describes his insecurities about performing on stage and the fear of not getting reactions out of an audience, as well as his insecurities when establishing meaningful relationships with the opposite sex. The book, believe it or not, ends in the summer of 1969 with the moment the first lines of the first sketch of the first episode of Monty Python's Flying Circus is recorded in a BBC TV studio. But Cleese decides to add an extra chapter for those Python fans who couldn't wait for a second volume to find out what went on behind the scenes from the point of view of probably one of the most popular members of Python. In a rather condensed yet satisfying manner, Cleese gives plenty of interesting insight on how some select Python sketches were written, the rather volatile creative process, especially between himself and Graham Chapman, and the mega successful series of live shows this past summer at the O2 Arena in London that marked the troupe's swan song, which were precipitated by legal fees of more than $1 million over a lawsuit dealing with profit sharing from the Python musical Spamalot. So in a way, it sort of ties everything up with Cleese's story without having to wait for Volume 2, although I would have liked to find out the evolution of Fawlty Towers and maybe the Ministry of Silly Walks. But all in all, for most parts, So Anyway is a book that Python fans may or may not have been waiting to read for a long time, as we find out how John Cleese, a lanky potential teacher lawyer, became a multidimensional, rather reluctant comedy legend on both sides of the Atlantic.
You know, there's so much he has done, from Monty Python to things like A Fish Named Wanda. You mentioned Fawlty Towers, of course. James Bond fans know him as the second Q. But there's one thing about John Cleese that I truly, truly adore, and it's a little known film that he did called Clockwise, which I just live by.
Yes, I heard it was quite he did quite a great performance actually for in that movie. But also did a lot of great commercials too, a lot of funny commercials also.
If there's anybody out there who is somewhat anal retentive like I am, there is a line in Clockwise which I have always lived by, and that is it's because the story deals with him being a professor, ironically, who's trying to get to another school where he's going to be giving a conference, and the series of misadventures that leads him to being delayed. And being someone who lives by time, this is extremely frustrating to him. And he has one line of exasperation near three quarters into the film, which I burst a gut when I saw it, and I've lived by ever since. And that line is, I can stand, it's not the despair. I could stand the despair. It's the hope. and love that line.
And delivered in the the typical Cleese fashion, it probably sounds really great.
Plus, he's crawling along the ground in a friar's frock at the time, which you have to see the film to know what that was all about. Anyway, the book is called?
It's called So Anyway by John Cleese, published by Doubleday Canada. And it's $32.95.
And is there anything else that you recommend in that similar vein?
Oh, there's plenty in the Python canon. But two books that stand out for me amongst the many books I buy and about Monty Python are, first of all, Michael Palin did a whole series of diaries. But consider the volume between that covers the years 1969-1979, the Python year. So it's called Diaries 69-79, the Python Years by Michael Palin. A lot of great inside stuff there. And also, The Pythons, the autobiography by The Pythons, which was released about 9 years ago as a coffee table book, but has just been re-released in a more manageable hardcover. And it's basically an oral autobiography of the group told by all the members, including Graham Chapman also. So those two books I highly recommend.
Okay, and again, this week's book is?
It's called So Anyways by John Cleese, published by Doubleday Canada, $32.95.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm going to go pine for the fjords.
And again, how do people find you?
Well, they can find me in the Montreal Times, not the London Times, but the Montreal Times. And you could, if you can't see me on the paper, you can read me online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you, Stuart.
Welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolan with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way, but I have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to that point. Carolyn Bibbs of Fellsmere, Florida, says neighbor Billy Wall came to her door asking if he could get a change of clothes. He was drenched with blood because I seen it all down his leg, she said. I ain't giving him no clothes to put on. The police showed up shortly afterward, though, because Wall had allegedly stabbed his own nephew twice, damaging his liver, and he needed surgery. As they handcuffed him, officers said Wall admitted to stabbing Charles Williams, but claimed it was self-defense. He say he tried to get a machete on me and cut me with a machete, so I stabbed him. Okay. And what started the argument? Wall says he only got one pork chop for dinner, and his nephew ate three. Well, blood is thicker than water, but pork fat is thicker than blood. And okay, we have a couple of stories here under the heading of Brits behaving Britishly bad, although I must admit the first one isn't horribly awful, just somewhat boorish. Here it is. Literature professor Thomas Dockery was back at work in October following his 9-month suspension from the University of Warwick for inappropriate sighing during meetings with a senior colleague, along with making ironic comments and negative body language. Okay, those just sound like all the things John Cleese might do while playing the role of Basil Fawlty. And 9 months seems kind of harsh. I mean, if it were me, I really don't see my sighing improving after a 9-month suspension. Anyway, here's item number 2, and this one is a bit more whack. In October, 51-year-old Andrew Davies was ordered by magistrates in High Wycombe, England, not to lie down in public places anymore unless genuinely stricken by emergency. Previously, he had a habit of making bogus 999 calls, that's like 911 calls here in North America, to get attention. And when police confiscated his phone, he began compensating by lying in roads until compassionate passers-by called for an ambulance. Okay, you know, if this isn't a cry for help, I really don't know what is. Honestly. And 3 women, whose ages range from 24 to 41, were charged with larceny on Black Friday in Hadley, Massachusetts, when they were caught in the Walmart parking lot, loaded down with about $2,700 worth of allegedly shoplifted goods. The women had moments earlier begged a Walmart employee for help getting into their car because they had locked themselves out. Not that I condone crime, but if you were going to shoplift at a Walmart, why would you not make sure you didn't lock your keys in the car? You know, I came dangerously close to making these ladies the idiot of the day, but I refrained because this next story takes the prize. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
A couple apparently thought they were trapped inside a janitor's closet at a local college in Florida for 2 days until police let them out. There was only one problem. The door was unlocked the entire time. 31-year-old John Arwood and 25-year-old Amber Campbell face trespassing charges. And by the way, I've seen their mugshots. What a handsome-looking couple. Campbell is also accused of violating her parole. Human feces and copper scouring pads, sometimes used to smoke crack, were found inside the closet. The couple told police they were chased into the closet, and after 2 days, Arwood called 911 from a cell phone. Okay, you know I have to ask. Why would 2 people think they were locked in a closet for 2 days when there was no lock on the door? And even if there was a lock on the door, they had a cell phone. So why wait 2 whole days to use it to secure their freedom? Well, one reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0281. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0281. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes. Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.